Hello again. This is Randall Rickman from Triangle Radio Reading Service. For this hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine. And welcome back. This issue is dated May 27th, 2019. We go right to the back of the book so we can ensure that we cover the interview feature. And the interview subject for this issue is John Paul Stevens. And the feature is called, this week, is called 10 Questions. Time says John Paul Stevens, the former Supreme Court Justice, 99, reflects on his significant decisions on and off the bench in The Making of a Justice. First question. You believe that District of Columbia v. Heller, which held that the Second Amendment protected an individual's right to bear arms, and from which you dissented, was the worst decision the court made during your tenure. Why is that? Answer. It's quite wrong on the merits. But beyond that, it seemed to me quite outrageous to depart from a settled rule of law. As history has demonstrated in recent years, the tragedies are multiplying one after another, and the decision of the court in Heller has contributed to that. Question. Are there any decisions you personally regret? Answer. One of the death penalty cases in my first year on the court. We should have put the statute in that case in the group of mandatory death penalty statutes that we held unconstitutional. So I think I got that wrong. Question. You write that when you arrived in Washington in 1951, quote, the members of the two parties respected one another and cooperated, unquote. Is something broken in Washington today? Answer. It's much more adversarial. I think maybe the people in elected positions are more interested in preserving their jobs than in doing the best job possible. Question. You claim the introduction of television had an impact on the confirmation process. How so? Answer. My hearings were not televised, and on the first morning, 5 minutes after I'd been introduced, they started asking questions. Now the first day is consumed by statements by the senators about how important the hearings are. Question. Should oral arguments at the Supreme Court be televised? Answer. That's a very difficult question, and I have been close to both sides of it. But I still think the procedure works more effectively without television. Question. You write that Clarence Thomas's views on the Constitution were more important to you during his hearings than the controversy over Anita Hill's allegations of sexual misconduct. Do you feel the same way about Brett Kavanaugh and Christine Blasey Ford? Answer. I think in both cases, the quality of their judicial work is far more important than the other issues. Question. What do you think of the idea bouncing around in the 2020 Democratic primary to expand the Supreme Court? Answer. I'm not in favor. I think in the long run, the number 9 is correct. Question. You used to have your pilot's license and wrote that you'd always wished you'd flown President Ford. Answer. I still have the license. I guess I quit some time before I retired. I really think if I had the guts to ask him, he might have accepted. Question. You had an agreement with Justice David Souter that he would let you know honestly when you had declined mentally and should retire. Should Supreme Court justices have term limits? Answer. No. I've always thought they're able to work it out for themselves. Question. If you had served 3 more days, you would have tied Justice Stephen Johnson Field's record for the second longest serving justice. Do you wish you'd stayed on? Answer. No, it's not a particularly interesting achievement. And Justice Field stopped working full-time a couple of months before he retired, so maybe I should be put in second place. Final question. The memoir was partly inspired by the big party your wife threw to celebrate your 94th birthday. How do you want to celebrate your 100th? Final answer. I better wait and see. I'll face that question when it's a little closer. Interview conducted for Time by Tessa Berenson with John Paul Stevens, former Supreme Court Justice, 99. And before we go to the front of the book, we want to also include this particular item. We don't want to miss this. Under appreciation, and then the subsection is movies. The headline is, Doris Day had more than charm. Observance by Stephanie Zakaric. Casual moviegoers who know Doris Day only from the early 1960s comedies she did with Rock Hudson or James Garner would have enough reasons to love her. In those pictures, Day, who died on May 13th at age 97, was a sunny, carbonated presence whose understated carnality bubbled just under the surface. Part of it was her speaking voice, a mysterious elixir viewed through amber-colored glass. Her singing voice magnified that magic. Day, born Doris Marianne Kappelhoff in Cincinnati, was so charming as a presence that it was sometimes easy to lose sight of what a phenomenal actor she was. In Alfred Hitchcock's The Man Who Knew Too Much, 1956, she's a devoted mother who is practically feral, so distraught over her son's kidnapping that she reverts to a state of wildness. As a stylized version of 1920s songstress Ruth Etting in Love Me or Leave Me, parenthetically 1955, she pulses between vulnerability and conviction, sometimes hitting both in the same beat. Once you get going, there are almost too many Doris Days to count. Day's career had its ups and downs. In 1968, when her third husband died, she found he had committed her to a TV series she didn't want to do. But Day used the show to champion animal welfare, the cause closest to her heart. There you have yet another Doris Day. But all sprang from the same person. There was only one Doris Marianne Kappelhoff, and how lucky we were to have her. Stephanie Zakaric writing about Doris Day. This item is accompanied by a half-length color photograph, and the caption says, Day, pictured circa 1965, was surprised when she got her first film role as she considered herself primarily a singer. Now we go to the front of the book and the major opening section called Opener as part of The Brief. And the subsection is Trade, where the headline is The Real Trade War, Whose Rules Will Reign, by John Walcott. He writes, Ray Geiser, a soybean farmer in Corning, Iowa, is on the front lines of the escalating trade war between the U.S. and China. Last fall, he was optimistic that the world's two largest economies would seal a deal that would keep his crops moving to market in China. But as tit-for-tat tariffs have made his soybeans less competitive, Geiser, 66, says it will be hard for many growers to turn a profit this year. Quote, farmers' patience is growing thin, unquote, he tells Time. The question that really scares him, quote, are we going to be in this for a long, long time, unquote. The answer almost certainly is yes. President Donald Trump's efforts to force China to buy more U.S. agricultural products open up to foreign businesses, and rewrite laws that incentivize intellectual property theft is part of a bigger challenge. It's not just that the U.S. and China, both of which announced billions of dollars worth of new tariffs in the first half of May, are competing over who will be the world's dominant economic, technological, and military power. It's a question of who writes the rules, not just for trade, but also for disputed areas from cyberspace to outer space. And that struggle is just getting started. The first step for the U.S. is to decide for itself what rules it wants to play by. Trump has talked of abandoning the World Trade Organization, parenthetically WTO, which has been the arbiter of U.S.-China trade for nearly 20 years. He's won applause in some quarters, including from Democrats on Capitol Hill, for his go-it-alone approach. But others see danger in the U.S.'s facing off with the Middle Kingdom on its own. Quote, for seven decades since World War II, a rules-based framework led by Washington has defined world order, producing an era without war among great powers, unquote. Harvard professor Graham Allison writes in his 2017 book, Destined for War, Can America and China Escape Thucydides' Trap? Quote, today, an increasingly powerful China is unraveling this order, throwing into question the peace generations have taken for granted, unquote. Much of the blame lies with Beijing. Successive Western leaders bet that, quote, constructive engagement, unquote, with China's leaders would ease the world's most populous nation into the liberal, free-trading world order. After China joined the WTO in 2001, it made occasional nods to Western trade rules, but as it gained economic clout, it increasingly resisted demands to transform its state-controlled economy. In the interest of getting as much material as we can into our brief time, we move forward. On the facing page, under the bulletin, the headline is, As Rationing Begins, Cuba Braces for Economic Impact from Venezuela Crisis. Article by Abigail Abrams, who writes, Fallout from the power struggle in Venezuela can be felt far beyond its borders, perhaps nowhere more than in Cuba. The U.S. has said Havana's support for strongman Nicolas Maduro is helping him stay in power in Caracas. As punishment, the Trump administration has imposed sanctions on Cuba. While Havana has pushed back on the accusation, it seems the island cannot escape the effects of the Venezuela conflict. Cuba announced new rations on food and hygiene products on May 10th, stoking fears of a worsening economic crisis. Stoking fears of a worsening economic crisis. Writer Abigail Abrams now lists three categories. The first category is limited supply. Cuba's Interior Commerce Minister, Betsy Diaz Velasquez, said the country would start restricting the purchase of basics such as chicken, rice, beans, and hygiene products like soap to ensure, quote, equal distribution, unquote, for all. Rationing had already begun in some parts of Cuba, and shoppers have complained for weeks of empty shelves and long lines. But the new policy will apply across the country and likely have a particularly intense effect on Cuba's burgeoning private businesses, which often rely on state-run stores for supplies because of the government's domination of imports and exports. From afar is the second category. Those imports are at the heart of the problem. Cuba imports two-thirds of its food each year, and Diaz said it's had to find new sources since Washington has expanded sanctions amid controversy over Havana's relationship to Maduro. Parenthetically, Cuba denies military involvement in Venezuela, but recently signaled openness to helping negotiate peace there. Last month, the Trump administration also announced it will limit money Cuban Americans can send family there and allow U.S. citizens to sue for property seized after Cuba's 1959 revolution. Third category, be prepared. It's not just food. Cuba's economy grew in the late 1990s and early 2000s, thanks in part to an influx of oil from Venezuela, supplies of which have also collapsed in recent months as the situation there worsens. But many Cubans remember the depression that followed the fall of the Soviet Union and worry that food and fuel shortages may be a sign of more trouble to come. Quote, it's not about returning to the harshest phase of the economic crisis of the 90s, unquote, Communist Party head Raul Castro said last month, quote, although we do have to be ready for the worst, unquote. Entire article by Abigail Abrams. Sharing this page in the right-hand margin is the regular feature called News Ticker. Three news items stacked one on top of the other. Top item, WhatsApp security flaw revealed. The instant messaging service WhatsApp announced on May 13th that hackers had been able to inject spyware into phones by exploiting a security flaw. The company, which is owned by Facebook, urged its 1.5 billion users to update their apps as soon as possible. Second item, Trump welcomes far-right PM. President Donald Trump called Hungary's authoritarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban, quote, highly respected, unquote, and said he is doing a, quote, tremendous job, unquote, during the European leader's May 13th visit to the White House. Human rights and democracy advocates have criticized Orban's embrace of far-right actions and rhetoric. Third item, drones hit Saudi oil pipeline. Saudi Arabia said on May 14th that an oil pipeline in its eastern province had been struck by a drone attack. Houthi rebels in Yemen said they had launched cross-border drone attacks against the kingdom, which has been involved in Yemen's ongoing civil war, and in backing the coalition fighting the Houthis since 2015. Moving forward, and that brings us to the milestones page. The lead item under died. Peggy Lipton, counterculture icon, observance by Kyle MacLachlan. Time says MacLachlan is an actor. He writes, Peggy Lipton's performance as Julie Barnes on the Mod Squad made a huge impact on my whole generation. The show was decidedly not meant for our parents, and Peggy, who died on May 11th at 72, was a revelation. She represented a type of person not seen on television before, the quintessential example of a new kind of woman, young and hip, with a resilience that complemented a truly gentle spirit. Later, she played a more personal yet equally influential role in my life when we worked together on Twin Peaks. Peggy brought mystery and strength in equal measure to the character of Norma, who ran the Double R Diner. She radiated a sense of purpose, and her performance on the show in many ways mirrored Peggy, the unique individual. She was always gracious and ever thoughtful. and moved to her own rhythm. She was wise and seemed all-knowing, and I instinctively felt that her world was full and complete, and far more fascinating than she would ever reveal to the rest of us. When she poured you a coffee at the counter at the Double R, her smile and calming voice made everything feel all right with the world. And she made one hell of a cherry pie. Observance by Kyle MacLachlan on Peggy Lipton. This item is accompanied by a full-color headshot. The caption says, Lipton poses for a portrait circa 1967, shortly before the Mod Squad made her a household name. Underdyed, actor Tim Conway, known for his role on The Carol Burnett Show, on May 14th at age 85. Underendorsed, the Christchurch Call, New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern's plan to push platforms to help eliminate online extremism by 18 governments and top tech firms, endorsed by 18 governments and top tech firms on May 15th. The U.S. did not join due to its free speech concerns. Underextended, Sri Lanka's nationwide curfew for a second night on May 14th after anti-Muslim violence sparked by the Easter bombings. Underpleaded guilty by actor Felicity Huffman, who admitted on May 13th that she arranged for her daughter's SAT exam to be altered as part of the college admissions scandal revealed this spring. Under-testified that the New York City police officer who killed Eric Garner in 2014 used a prohibited chokehold on him, testified by an NYPD training official during the officer's disciplinary trial May 14th. Under re-elected, President Cyril Ramaphosa and the African National Congress by South African voters on May 11th. Underended, an annual Austrian ball that raises money for HIV/AIDS causes, ended as progress on treatment has made it harder to find sponsors. On the facing page, we have the regular feature called Postcard, where the headline is, The Godfather of Brexit Returns to Rile Up the UK. Article by Billy Perigo. Dateline, Clacton-on-Sea, UK. When the sun shines on Clacton-on-Sea, on the east coast of England, the town comes alive with sunbathers, kids playing arcade machines, and shopkeepers hawking beach balls on the sandswip promenade. But the sky on a recent spring morning was overcast and had hung over a different sort of crowd. Hundreds gathered at Clacton's Pier on April 23rd, many bearing pro-Brexit placards and wearing Union Jack pins, as the man they had come to see, Nigel Farage, stepped up to speak. A local politician hailed him by a nickname, the Godfather of Brexit. Farage's lobbying was indeed instrumental to the UK's decision to leave the European Union in the referendum of June 2016, especially his vociferous anti-migrant sentiment. But days after the result, he abruptly resigned his position as leader of the UK Independence Party, parenthetically UKIP. Quote, my political ambition, unquote, he said at the time, quote, has been achieved, unquote. Now Farage is back and touring the Brexit heartland in search of another political upset. This time, the target is the European Parliament elections scheduled for May 23rd. Had Britain left the EU on March 29th, as originally planned, the vote would not be happening here. But in the months leading up to the date, Prime Minister Theresa May could not persuade lawmakers to ratify her EU exit deal and asked for a delay. Now Brexit has been pushed back to October 31st. Now the UK must, by law, vote for candidates in the European legislature. That was enough to bring the Brexit godfather, who left UKIP completely last year, back into politics. In April, he launched the Brexit Party to compete in the EU elections. His message is, again, one of insurgent anger. Quote, "We have openly and willfully been betrayed by our government," unquote, he told the pro-leave crowd in Clacton to cheers and applause. It appears to be working. According to one poll, 34% of voters plan to back Farage in the EU elections, ahead of both May's Conservatives and the official opposition, Labour Party. The victory would be mostly symbolic, as any elected lawmakers would stand down once Brexit finally happens. But for May, who has been fending off calls to resign for months, a poor performance in EU elections might be the final straw for her premiership. For her Conservative Party, it threatens to echo the impact that Farage had on policy as the leader of UKIP in the early 2010s, emboldening Eurosceptics and pushing the government rightward. And for the country, it could add yet another wrinkle in the stuttering political process to bid the EU farewell. No political upset could possibly match the scale of Farage's victory in 2016. But as seagulls circled over Clacton, he warned that 2019 could be the start of something at least comparable. Quote, "Do you believe that this political class now needs to be swept aside and replaced by better people?" Unquote. The crowd roared yes. Quote, "Well, that is what we are going to do." Unquote. Entire article by Billy Perigo. On this page, also in the left margin, is another version of regular feature News Ticker. And once again, it's three news items stacked on top of each other. Top item. Top court okays Apple antitrust case. The U.S. Supreme Court on May 13th said it would let an antitrust case against Apple move forward, allowing consumers to sue the company over the 30% commission it takes on App Store sales, which the plaintiffs say is an abuse of its power. Apple argued that only app developers should bring such a suit. Middle item, CO2 hits record levels in atmosphere. Scientists said on May 11th that levels of atmospheric carbon dioxide, which contributes to the greenhouse effect, reached highs last seen more than 3 million years ago, at which point sea levels were some 50 feet higher than today. CO2 now makes up 415 molecules out of every million in the air, up from 400 in 2013. Final item. Barr opens review of Russia inquiry. That's Barr spelled B-A-R-R. Item says, U.S. Attorney General William Barr has told Connecticut's top federal prosecutor to investigate how the Russia probe began, a move President Trump wanted, but that law enforcement officials say is unnecessary. This is the third known Justice Department inquiry into the Russia investigation. Entire contents of News Ticker. And moving forward, we're now at the major section called The View. The subsection here is World, where the headline is Selling Democracy by Ian Bremmer. Nearly three decades after the Cold War's end, it's no longer clear that American-style liberal democracy has carried the day. Xi Jinping has consolidated power in China on a scale not seen since Mao. Vladimir Putin has served longer than any other Russian leader since Stalin. Even many democracies are being undermined by populism. Democracy remains the form of government most likely to create lasting security and prosperity. A few oil-producing nations aside, the world's wealthiest countries are democracies. And democracies are also less likely to go to war with one another. For these reasons, Americans have long believed that if all the world's countries were to become democracies, everyone would live safer and more prosperous lives. But is the U.S.-style democracy the right path for all? A new study conducted by the Eurasia Group Foundation, parenthetically EGF, has produced interesting findings on public attitudes in other countries toward the U.S. and its system of government. Based on surveys of citizens in eight countries, Brazil, China, Egypt, India, Nigeria, Poland, Germany, and Japan, the report, authored by Mark Hanna, found support in all these countries for democracy, but mixed attitudes toward the U.S. and its democracy. A few interesting data points. Data point. Brazilians appear disappointed with their own democracy, but some 70% have a favorable view of American ideas of democracy. Point. Respondents in China were three times as likely to want their system of government to become more like the American system as less like it. Three times. Data point. About 80% of Indians surveyed have a very or somewhat favorable view of the U.S. and of the American people, in part because 70% of them have recently had a close friend or family member living in the U.S. 70%. Data point. Those surveyed in Germany and Japan, longtime U.S. allies, were least enthusiastic about U.S.-style democracy. More than half of Germans reported an unfavorable view. Those are the three data points used. Moving on in the article, the survey found that in wealthy countries, opposition to President Trump and perceptions of income inequality drove unfavorable opinions of the U.S. Respondents overwhelmingly favored democracy as practiced in their own countries. Those in emerging market democracies dislike the active role the U.S. sometimes plays in other countries. But they say that U.S. democracy safeguards the rule of law more effectively than their own democracies do. Most citizens in authoritarian countries do not like U.S. foreign policy, but they do want greater political freedom in their own countries. The findings from these countries suggest that while democracy remains a popular aspiration around the world, attraction will prove more effective than promotion as a way to help democracy expand. The report argues that the U.S. has made four main mistakes in fostering democracy abroad. U.S. policymakers have focused on the laws and institutions of other countries, but not their political cultures. They've assumed that people will forego near-term security and stability for the chance to vote. They've used military intervention to promote democratic values without accounting for the problems this approach creates. And they've ignored the values and interests of those they hope to persuade. The survey also finds that allowing foreign-born people to study and live in the U.S. can help to promote democracy. Support for American ideas of democracy is driven largely by immigration and direct connections to diaspora communities. People who report having had family members or close friends who have lived in America in the past 5 years are significantly more likely to have positive views. That's one reason U.S. policymakers would be more successful if they found the modesty to promote democracy around the world without the explicit American packaging, and with the humility to acknowledge that the U.S. has often failed to live up to democracy's highest ideals. Democracy's appeal comes in the power it gives individuals to set their own course. America should accept that each country will need to find its own path to adopt democracy. Entire article by Ian Bremmer. Time says Bremmer is founder and board president of EGS. That's Eurasia Group Foundation. On this page also, in the right margin, is the sidebar feature called Short Reads. Time explains highlights from stories on time.com/ideas. There are three items stacked one on top of the other. First sample, what went down easy? A new JAMA study found that after Philadelphia imposed a soda tax, quote, purchases dropped by 38% compared to the year before, translating to almost a billion fewer ounces sold, unquote, writes Times' Jamie Ducharme. One study author called these policies a, quote, no-brainer, unquote. Second sample, who's held in contempt? Martin London, a former attorney for Spiro Agnew, analyzes the possible outcomes of holding Attorney General William Barr in contempt of Congress over the Mueller report, and concludes that the most likely is, quote, those who will decide the fate of Trump's presidency are the people who gave him a chance in the first place, the voters, unquote. Final sample, when joy is a concern. When Dan McLean, author of the new book, We Live for the We, became pregnant. I'll correct that from the very beginning. The author's name is Danny McLean. First name spelled D-A-N-I, McLean, M-little-c, capital C, L-A-I-N. When Danny McLean, author of the new book, We Live for the We, became pregnant, she strategized so that, as a black parent in America, she would not raise her child to be afraid, quote, for black families, unquote, she writes, quote, engaging in joyful practices is necessary to our survival, to our ability to fully claim our humanity, unquote. Three excerpts from stories on time.com/ideas. Moving ahead, we are now in the subsection called Nation, where the headline is A Family's Value. Billions of Americans could finally get paid parental leave if lawmakers can agree who pays. Article by Abby Vasulis. She writes, for the first 5 months of Morgan Lyles' high-risk pregnancy with twins, her fiancé, Chris Wien, was by her side, assembling the double-wide stroller and watching the squiggles of two heartbeats on ultrasound monitors. They'd purchased car seats for their SUVs and confirmed that Lyles would take maternity leave from her job as an attorney for the state of Ohio after the babies were born. But when Wyan suffered a series of seizures that sent him to the intensive care unit for nearly 2 weeks when Lyles was 20 weeks pregnant, Lyles couldn't afford to be there with him. She had only 4 weeks of paid family leave from her job at 70% of her salary, and was terrified of dipping into her paid vacation and sick time, knowing the twins would need her later. Quote, "I've got to save what leave I can," unquote, she recalls telling a colleague who was shocked to see her in the office while her fiancé was in the hospital. It still wasn't enough. Mara and Lena were born on March 2nd, about 2 months after their dad was discharged. They were just over 3 pounds each, and both suffered from a minor brain bleed. Lyles exhausted her allotted paid maternity leave before the girls even came home from the neonatal intensive care unit in April. Though the couple is anxious about the coming deluge of medical bills, Lyles has little choice but to use unpaid leave now, too, to care for her premature twins. Taking time off for a newborn isn't as hard in other countries. If Lyles lived in Bulgaria, which has one of the world's most generous paid maternity leave laws, she'd get nearly 59 weeks of maternal leave at 90% of her salary, and an additional year of parental leave she and Wyan could split. If she lived in Chile, she'd receive 18 weeks at 100% of her salary, and an additional 12 weeks to split. Even in Iraq, she'd have gotten 14 weeks at 100% of her salary. In fact, the U.S. is the only industrialized nation on the planet that doesn't guarantee paid parental leave through a federal law. If an attorney like Morgan Lyles can't cobble together enough paid time off to be with her sick fiancé and care for her babies, the challenges can be even starker for the 83% of civilian workers without any paid family leave at all. Quote, "We have every incidence of privilege, and it's still incredibly hard," unquote, Lyles says, as she breastfeeds one baby and Wyan bottle feeds the other in the living room of their 3-bedroom home in Columbus. Quote, "I have no idea what people who aren't similarly situated do. I can't even imagine," unquote. It's not that the U.S. doesn't recognize the problem. Polls show that voters overwhelmingly back the concept of paid family leave. A 2017 Pew study found that 82% of Americans supported mandatory paid leave for mothers after a birth or adoption. Now, this broad public demand has spurred new efforts to fix it. The White House, Republican senators, and big businesses have recently joined traditional advocates on the left to champion paid family leave. Some states and major corporations have created their own policies, and a variety of proposals are circulating in Congress. It's clear that the odds of Americans getting paid family leave have never been better. What's not clear is whether lawmakers can find a bipartisan solution. The biggest sticking point is how to pay for it. A handful of Republican senators have introduced versions of a national paid family leave policy over the past year, which would be funded by delaying or reducing a parent's Social Security checks down the road. That's anathema to Democrats like New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, who with Connecticut Representative Rosa DeLauro has been pushing a paid leave bill called the Family Act since 2013. Family is all caps in the Family Act. Quote, "I don't think it's fair that you have to choose between your retirement and paid leave," unquote, Gillibrand, a presidential candidate, tells Time. Gillibrand's plan would be funded by a 0.2% payroll tax levied on both employees and employers. That idea won't fly with Republicans. Quote, I don't believe we're going to ever be able to pass a bill anytime soon that will pass the House and Senate, be signed by the president, that creates a new government program, a new mandate on business, or raises taxes, unquote, says GOP Senator Marco Rubio, whose New Parents Act, co-sponsored by Senator Mitt Romney, would offer new parents up to 3 months of paid leave in exchange for future Social Security payments. Americans don't want it to come out of their pockets either. Some three-quarters of Americans would support a federal program offering 12 weeks of paid leave that could be used by both new parents and people dealing with their own or a family member's medical issue. But only 54% back the idea if it came with a $200 annual tax hike, according to a 2018 public opinion poll by the Cato Institute, a libertarian think tank. Whether the two parties can reconcile their differences is what stands in the way of tens of millions more adults in the U.S. labor force getting paid family leave. In the meantime, nearly a quarter of employed moms have little choice but to return to work within 2 weeks of giving birth, according to a 2015 analysis by In These Times, a nonprofit magazine. It's a far cry from the 6 weeks or longer that doctors recommend after most births. But the sparks of progress have advocates hopeful that America may finally be on the cusp of solving one of its most vexing policy challenges. Moving ahead, we are now in the section called Time Off, and the subsection is Opener, and the subgroup is Television, where the headline is, Game of Thrones is Over. Is That So Bad? Article by Judy Berman. She writes, Game of Thrones fans have witnessed countless deaths in its final season, but the show's most painful casualty is yet to come, as Netflix firehoses content and streaming services keep emerging to spend media giants' intellectual property into gold. Critics like me have been fretting over the slow demise of television as mass cultural event. That panic has crystallized around Thrones, a series that remains both hugely popular and acclaimed at a time when ratings and prestige sometimes seem mutually exclusive. This kind of consensus hit can be really healthy for a society as fragmented as ours. Divided by class, politics, and identity, 43 million of us can at least come together to watch Thrones. If fantasy buffs, academics, proponents of strong female characters, the Gay of Thrones recappers, Black Twitter, Barack Obama, J-Lo, Tom Brady, and Beyonce are all losing their minds over the same thing at the same time, the demise of that collective obsession is worth lamenting, or so the argument goes. Yet, I'm not sure I agree. As anyone who's been in the crosshairs of a massive online fan community, Thrones is included, can tell you, an entertainment monoculture isn't inherently good. A lively cultural conversation may be desirable, but the content of that conversation also matters. And when it comes to Thrones, I'm not convinced that this particular discourse still deserves the hand-wringing. This is partly the fault of the show itself. Stellar performances, an HBO pedigree, and early seasons that invested as much energy in character development and ideological conflicts as they now devote to CGI, made Thrones the kind of drama everyone was obliged to take seriously. Parenthetically, even the criticisms about rape and exploitative depictions of female characters that have followed the show for its entire run presuppose that viewers should expect more sophistication out of this narrative than the typical fantasy quest. But it's become a very different story since creators David Benioff and D.B. Weiss started diverging from George R.R. Martin's text, which they outpaced in Season 5. Episodes like Battle of the Bastards and Beyond the Wall Battle Hardhome built up to April's The Long Night, which devoted its full 82-minute runtime to the fiery, icy, dimly lit Battle of Winterfell. Directed by Miguel Sapochnik, all three episodes were technical marvels on a scale that TV had never attempted before. But it's telling that it's these moments, rather than character beats or ethical dilemmas, that now generate the most anticipation and analysis. Twitter spent days after The Long Night poking holes in Jon Snow's strategy. Parenthetically, the next week's big talking point was the stunning sloppiness of a coffee cup left in one shot. Viewers looking for more than expensive spectacle have spent the past few seasons mourning the witty, thought-provoking show that they started watching. Now, episodes feel too thematically slight to justify all the chatter they inspire. A lot of that talk has revolved around clues, Easter eggs, and callbacks to scenes from 2011 or 2012. To some extent, that's a natural trajectory for a show with such grand ambition. Thrones spent years building Westeros. The payoff is a captive audience's immersion in its history and lore. Yet there's a difference between making the most of an established setting and letting minutiae overtake big ideas. That goes double for a show that in its final season has played so fast and loose with characters. It's made Daenerys a monster, Tyrion a fool, and reduced the formidable Brienne of Tarth to a weeping puddle of thirst for Jaime Lannister, arguably without earning any of it. Meanwhile, for reasons that have as much to do with the redditization of cultural criticism as they do with the series devolution, more substantive conversations of the kind early seasons encouraged have gotten drowned out by fan theories, publicity stunts, and character obsession, the kind of stuff that makes my eyes glaze over. Millions of us watch Daenerys and her lover-slash-nephew Jon ride dragons in a Season 8 premiere interlude that played like a preview of the inevitable theme park ride. What did it do for us as a society? To be clear, this isn't an indictment of TV that entertains more than it provokes thought. Parenthetically, take it from someone who savored every episode of Lindsay Lohan's Beach Club. Still, with something like 500 scripted series airing every year, it's fair to ask, why is Game of Thrones the only one we all seem to agree is good, profound, and, despite the incest and magic, universally relatable? Many of the answers are obvious. It's based on widely loved books. It predated the streaming boom. It's a one-stop shop for weird sex and TVMA violence. HBO has sunk enormous sums of money into it, including a marketing budget sufficient to make the announcement of a distant premiere date break the internet. This is another way of saying that Thrones has flourished largely because it was set up to flourish. Because the people who bankroll prestige television decided up front that this story of battles, bastards, and butts was worth an episodic budget three times as large as that of the typical cable series. In turn, the kind of viewers who subscribed to a channel that once had the tagline, "It's not TV, it's HBO," a group that might otherwise have dismissed the show as genre trash, embraced it instead. This isn't a bad thing in isolation. Water cooler TV of generations past tended to be grounded in the particulars of contemporary American life. Even Seinfeld sparked debate over social norms. But authors from Edgar Allan Poe to Octavia Butler have long since proved that genre fiction can speak just as eloquently to the human experience as realism. What's frustrating is how narrow the brand of entertainment populism that elevated Game of Thrones to such an exalted plane of cultural significance and kept it there, even as the quality of its storytelling slipped, tends to be. As with film, it seldom seems to benefit genres or audiences that aren't predominantly white and male. There are exceptions, of course. Black Panther, Gone Girl, The Handmaid's Tale. And we have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. We hope you've enjoyed it and gained something from it. Please be sure to listen next time. I'm Randall Rickman, reading for Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. That's TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Once again, 919-832-5138. So long until next time, this is your loyal reader, Randall Rickman, thanking you for your presence and your patience. Please join us next time for Time.